6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for the hour. My name is Alan Ruff. With a U.S. attack on Syria looming, in the very near future, probably. We're going to talk about Syria today. We want to talk about Syria in the context of the broader region and a longer history of U.S. meddling in that region. We're going to be doing a two-parter this hour. We will be joined later in the hour by Middle East historian and observer Jennifer Lowenstein. But before Jennifer joins us, on the phone with us is Robert Perry. Robert Perry is an investigative journalist, author, founder of Consortium News. He was one of the key reporters who helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal in the 80s and concurrently with that, the October surprise that brought Ronald Reagan to power in 1980. He's been an observer of the, I think we could say the perversion of the political process. He's also been an astute media critic and has worked on exposing the complicity of mainstream journalism in the contemporary imperial project. Robert Bob Perry, welcome back to WORT.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad to have you back. Bob, you know, before we get into into the whole question of this impending attack, U.S. attack on Syria, which in a piece you just did, you talked about it as doing a bizarre replay of America's disastrous rush to judgment on Iraq. But before we get to that, let's talk about some of the broader context for this. You've been a student for, three, four decades now of the longer history of U.S. involvement in the Middle East that has carried us to this present situation. Talk about that in the broader region and the, there's been a long history of, let's be blunt, of lies, distortions, disassembling, and all sorts of black ops carried out by the U.S., especially in regard to Iran, and of course that longer arc of history carries us to the present. So let's start with your recent work on Iran.
Well, clearly there's been this interest with the Middle East because of its richness in oil and its strategic placement generally in the world. So the various colonial powers back even farther, going back to the 19th century, were trying to get control of this area, and through the various battles and wars of the early to mid-20th century, that continued. And then after World War II, the United States increasingly stepped in to protect Western interests, particularly access to oil. And we saw in 1953, when the British wanted to keep control of the oil in Iran, and of Prime Minister Mossadegh, who was a freely elected nationalistic leader in Iran, wanted to claim control of that oil for the nation, for the Iranian people, that upset the British. In the midst of the Cold War, early stages of the Cold War, and the United States through the CIA decided that Mossadegh had to go. And just recently, just in the last week or so, the CIA finally formally admitted what it had long tried to dissemble or lie about, really, that it had participated in this effort to get rid of Mossadegh and to install the Shah of Iran on the peacock throne and allow his autocratic police state to control that country from 53 on to 79 when he was driven out by a popular uprising. But one of the ironies is that when we get to that period in 79 and 80, you had Jimmy Carter as president of the United States, and he had deeply offended many of the old Cold Warriors, including at the CIA. He'd been cutting back staff. He'd been laying people off. He was putting human rights and as a cornerstone of American foreign policy. These were things that the old CIA hands thought were dangerously naive and obviously not to their interest in that they were losing jobs. So you had what appears now, and this is still history that is somewhat in flux, but the evidence continues to build, that rogue elements of the CIA, including people who were active duty as well as people who had left the agency, joined with the Republicans and to some degree with the Iranian, some Iranians, and also with the Israeli intelligence operatives, to engineer kind of a coup d'etat against President Carter, because Carter was desperately in 1980 trying to free 52 Americans who were being held hostage in Iran. They were taken after the Shah was allowed into the United States as part of a protest, and then that evolved into this standoff that went on for 444 days. But Carter was trying to get the hostages out, and it was in the interest of the Reagan campaign, which was seeking power in 1980 in the election, to see that he didn't. And although there still are very emphatic denials from the Republicans and from some other elements of official Washington, the evidence is now building to the point of being fairly conclusive that the Republicans did operate behind the scenes, working with some CIA people and collaborating with the Begin government in Israel, which also was very hostile to Jimmy Carter, and made contact with Iranians who helped keep those hostages in captivity through the election in 1980. So Carter looked like a rather much an inept, weak leader. Coincidentally, the takeover of the embassy and the presidential election matched up as sort of in the first anniversary of the hostage taking was the day of the election, so a lot of focus was on that at the time. And a fairly close race between Carter and Reagan ballooned into a Reagan landslide. And then he won the election rather decisively. And then on January 20th, 81, as Reagan was being sworn in, finally the Iranians let the hostages out. So Reagan came across as this great powerful leader who had frightened the Iranians into releasing the hostages. But it now appears, based on the evidence that has been accumulating over the years, that it was not just that timing was essentially orchestrated as part of this deal, and we now have some of the reasons this has been sort of dismissed was that when it came under investigation by Congress, which was sort of as a tail end of the Iran-Contra investigation, October surprise being sort of a prequel, if you will, to the Iran-Contra scandal, the efforts to look into it were met with aggressive cover-ups by the then George H.W. Bush White House. We now have the documents showing how aggressively they pursued that cover-up, how they kept witnesses from Congress, they withheld documents. President Bush had put Robert Gates in as director of CIA. Gates was a person implicated in the October surprise case, but as director of CIA in 91 and 92, he withheld documents that the Congress was trying to get. And ultimately, the Democrats in Congress, facing this very strong Republican resistance, threw in the towel, more or less. And they basically, even though more and more evidence was coming into them that the Republicans had done this in the latter part of their investigation in late 92, they pretty much decided to say, well, nothing happened. And so they put out a report to that effect, which really didn't make any sense for those of us who actually bothered to read it. There were alibis that were completely nonsensical. But over the years, we've been able to piece together more and more of the story, including the fact that we now know, based on documents I found at the Bush Library in College Station, Texas, that the White House had been informed that one of the key allegations of the October surprise, that William Casey had made a trip to Madrid for meetings with Iranians, had been partially corroborated by the State Department. The State Department reported that he had indeed made a trip to Madrid, which the White House had been saying he hadn't made, and that they hid that fact. They kept it from the Congress. It was a key point at the time. And when I brought this document to the attention of the person who had headed up the Congressional Task Force, Congressman Lee Hamilton, Democrat of Indiana, Hamilton finally agreed after a number of these kinds of me presenting him with a number of new documents that he had not been aware of. He agreed that they had been that the conclusion that they had reached, exonerating Reagan and Bush and the others, was no longer valid. That if this information had been given to them in a timely fashion, when it was instead withheld, that their investigation would have gone in a very different direction and might have reached a very different conclusion. So we have here now, still, I guess you might say, a disputed part of our history, but one in which the Republican guilt is, the evidence of that has built up.
Bob Perry, as we get into the 80s, it's the decade of the Iran-Iraq war. And one of the historical ironies of this past week or so is that we now have increased verification that the U.S. assisted Iraq in the prosecution of its war against Iran by providing it with not only the elements of gas warfare, but assisted with U.S. intelligence and satellite spotting and so on, where the Iran army was congregated, like in the Fal Peninsula and so on. And so now there's all this talk, of course, about, Syria has used gas, but the U.S. was complicit in that, chemical warfare utilized by the former friend, Saddam Hussein, in that war. Talk about that a little bit, please.
So after the 1980 thing events happened, let's assume that the evidence as we're seeing it is correct, that behind the scenes the Republicans struck a deal with the Iranians. Part of that deal would have been, this is according to various witnesses who say they were part of this and were in positions to know, they say that the agreement was that Israel would then provide weapons to the Iranians. And the war with Iraq had already begun. It begins in September of 1980. So the Iranians were in a position to get weapons that the U.S. was approving, and the Reagan administration approves these weapons secretly in 1981, and there's even a point where one of the plane carrying some of the weapons crashes, and there's some scattered disclosure about that in the summer of 81, but it's essentially covered up again by the Reagan administration. So what you're having really is a kind of a dual arrangement where the United States is giving permission or accepting that Israel will provide weapons to the Iranians, and the United States is also arranging, through third countries primarily, assistance for the Iraqis. In a sense, we're kind of fueling both sides of that conflict. At the time, CIA Director Casey, after Casey was running the Reagan campaign in 1980, he goes on to be CIA director and is very much a hardline cold warrior. He is enjoying the fact that the two countries are now bloodletting with each other, and he feels that's kind of a clever way to make a U.S. policy be successful in the region. So we go through the 80s where, at different points, Reagan will tilt mostly to the Iraqis because the Iranians may have an upper hand in the war, and so more supplies go to the Iraqis. Other times, you get other efforts to get more weapons to the Iranians, and you get, as when the Israelis intervene in 85 and 86 with getting direct American weaponry, that becomes known as the Iran-Contra scandal. The Reagan people secretly are providing sophisticated weapons, including Hawk anti-aircraft missile parts, to the Iranians. So we have this sort of really crazy strategy of fueling that war as it goes on through the 80s, and obviously causing a great deal of disruption all over the place. And there's always these efforts by the Reagan administration and then later the Bush administration to lie about and hide what was going on. Some of it is exposed during Iran-Contra, but a lot of it isn't. So you get to the point of the war with Iran-Iraq finally coming to an end in 88. You have But Saddam Hussein then moves, because he's now so in debt because of the cost of that war, he then puts pressure on the Kuwaitis to provide him some relief on his loans. They refuse. He then invades Kuwait, thinking that the U.S. is okay with it. He gets kind of a green light. He thinks he's an ally of the United States. And that leads to the first intervention by George H.W. Bush against Saddam Hussein in the effort to, quote, liberate Kuwait. So we end up with these policies having a number of complex ramifications that are kind of ignored and not there's not much thought that goes into where these things will lead and how they may end up complicating matters. The situation with the U.S. then invading, going into Kuwait to drive the Iraqis out, not only does it cause a great deal of human suffering, but it also offends a Saudi by the name of Osama bin Laden, who then takes the fact that the U.S. is positioning bases in Saudi Arabia as an affront, and that he then escalates his conflict with the United States through his organization known as Al-Qaeda. So we end up seeing these complications and as these wars continue to cascade, but the common thread is that the American people are always being kept pretty much in the dark about what's going on, what the real American role is, because much of it was done covertly. Much of it was done without the full story being told. We were being sold bills of goods, not really being engaged in a serious debate. We saw that, of course, when George H.W. Bush ran essentially a propaganda campaign to get us to rally around the liberation of Kuwait. We saw something then similar when that drags on and is heightened after 9/11, where George W. Bush decides he's going to finally settle the score with Saddam Hussein, and we invade Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein, again under false pretenses, again with the American people being deceived, and that leads to other complications. What the George W. Bush invasion of Iraq did, besides the horrible human consequence, both for the Iraqi people and the American soldiers pulled into it, it opened up this rift in the Muslim world between Sunnis and Shia. The violence in Iraq broke down along sectarian lines, and you saw this terrible bloodletting in what became kind of a civil war inside Iraq, which is still continuing to this day, where bombings happen pretty much daily. That also led to increased stresses throughout the region. And you've seen the Shiite side, Iran, Hezbollah, Syria, which is has an Alawite leadership, but that's sort of a branch of Shia Islam. And you have the Sunnis taking usually a different side, some of them more authoritarian in the nature of the Saudis. You have more of a populist group, let's say the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But you have all these now conflicting elements which have ripped apart the entire region. And it's really set the stage now for the kinds of additional conflicts that President Obama seems to be on the edge of joining.
Robert Perry, we got you for a few more minutes. Talk about your concerns regarding the current U.S. claims and reasons, reasons for why we should be skeptical based upon some of this longer history.
Well, first of all, the longer history is that we get deceived. So we should always assume that we're not getting the straight story. And that I don't mean to be unfair, because there are elements of U.S. intelligence that tries to be honest, but we've seen that they've often been overridden by political interests, by not just politicians, but also people in the intelligence community who have ideological desires that override their analysis of the facts. But in the case of the current case of Syria, there was this remarkable factoid that was included in a New York Times article yesterday, a sidebar. It was buried deep in it. But the New York Times reported that the evidence is that the delivery system for this alleged chemical weapon was an improvised rocket It was not something that was an official military delivery system. It was something that was sort of essentially handmade. And that could be a very significant point, because one of the big arguments that the Obama administration has made so far is that only the Syrian military has the rocketry to deliver this kind of a weapon. But according to the New York Times story, that's not true. This improvised, very homemade rocket was used. Now, if that's the case, there are different options. That it's either maybe was done by some of the Syrian rebels, perhaps some of the al-Qaeda elements that are now essentially leading the fight for the rebel side in Syria. It could also be that the Syrian government was trying to hide its role by using an improvised rocket as opposed to a normal one. But this sort of fact needs to be explored. It shouldn't just be buried at the end of a New York Times article, and it shouldn't be something that the Obama administration can just brush aside. We have to know if we need to know at least what the facts are in terms of what we can learn about the chemical weapons, that the UN should be given the full time to do it. Very strangely, Secretary of State Kerry was claiming that you could not ascertain anything about these chemical weapons because it had taken a few days to get to the site, but that just isn't true. All the experts say you can learn a great deal even months or even years later. So you have this again, this behavior, both on the part of the U.S. government and much of the Washington press corps, of jumping on a bandwagon to war without first examining all the facts and then sharing those facts with the American people in a meaningful way, not just pitching it to us and selling it to us in a propaganda way, but in actually giving us the information for us to make the judgments.
You know, I'm going to have to let you go very shortly, Bob Perry. But, you know, in the article you did, what was it, yesterday, on this, what you've just recounted, you talk about this striking you as a bizarre replay of America's disastrous rush to judgment on Iraq. Obviously, you see clear parallels.
Well, I mean, there are clear parallels. There are some differences, too.
I
think it's probably true that President Obama is a much more reluctant participant. The Bush administration under George W. Bush aggressively sold us on the war in Iraq. They tried to shout down and discredit anyone, and I was among those who were raising questions at the time in 2002 and 2003, and we were all being, you know, called names. We were Saddam sympathizers, et cetera, et cetera. It was quite ugly. I don't think we've seen that from the Obama administration. I think President Obama has been very reluctant to engage militarily in Syria or in other places. But he does seem to be pressured and is moving in that direction. So still, the standards of getting the facts straight and sharing them with the American people are still relevant, no matter who's in the White House.
Well, I want to thank you for giving us some time today. You've been listening to Robert Perry, who's an investigative journalist, author, and founder of Consortium News. What's that website?
It's consortiumnews.com.
Consortiumnews.com.
And some of the new material on the October surprise is in my new book, America's Stolen Narrative, and that's available at the website or at Amazon or other places.
All right. So, again, I want to thank you, and it's always very informative whenever we can get you on. So, again, thanks a lot, Bob Perry.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to continue on with our discussion of the looming attack, really, on Syria. And with us here in the studio is a lately infrequent, we've been missing you, Jennifer, infrequent guest on this and other WRT programs. Jennifer Lowenstein is a student of the Middle East, an observer, writes periodically for various blog sites and columns.
Teacher.
I'm sorry?
Well, I'm a student. I'm also a teacher.
No, no, I mean a student in yes. the grandest sense. We never stop being students, Jennifer. Yes. But yeah, as lectured at the UW on Middle East history and contemporary Middle East, and we're going to continue on our discussion. Jennifer, you know, there's you're again as a observer, a student of the broader region, the conflict as it appears to be escalating must certainly raise concerns for you and for any observers, critical observers, regarding the broader region. Let's start there.
Oh, my God. I usually try to start with the smallest part and move outward. I think that you're right, first of all. The situation in Syria is, first of all, it's very poorly understood. Most educated, politically interested people in the United States, people who read the newspaper or who watch the news, know virtually nothing about the state of Syria. You can't say that about Egypt. People know something here, you know, a little bit. They know something about Israel and, you know, by definition, about Palestine or the Palestinians. There are other countries the average news reader seems to have some information about. But when it comes to Syria, there is usually a big black blank in their minds. They know nothing of its background. And that is really one of the problems, because it allows the media and it allows our public education system and our private education system to teach, quote unquote, a history that may have no relevance whatsoever to history. When we talk about lies, I don't even know if those people teaching the history of, say, the Levant, in which Syria is included, I don't even know if they realize the lies they're telling, because they themselves don't know anything about Syria. It's very sad. So my point is simply that we're watching Egypt go down a black hole right now. I believe it is heading in a very bad direction. I would like to be optimistic. I don't think there are reasons for giving up hope, but I don't think that right now, in the short run, and at least, that we're going to a very pretty place. Syria is worse. The situation in Syria is more damaging, potentially, to the region, and more dangerous, not only to the people in the region, but to the people in the world, than the situation in Egypt will be.
And why is that?
The reason is because Syria is not one war. Syria is not one conflict. The situation in Syria started out with a group of nonviolent civilian protesters demanding reform from the Assad government. They weren't demanding regime change. They weren't demanding a coup or an overthrow of this person or that person within the government. They were demanding reforms, greater freedoms of speech, greater freedoms of assembly, and they were nonviolent, and they were in a small town. In fact, a town that many of the higher leadership, or some of the higher leadership, are very familiar with. Some of them are from there, from Deraa. The problem that the misfortune of that episode is that because of the broader Arab Spring, as it is referred to, I don't think we're seeing an Arab Spring at all, but the broader events happening across the Arab world, I believe, may have caused the Assad regime to respond much too quickly and much too violently to a nonviolent protest than it should have. And it killed civilians, it brought out its military, it fired on people without arms, and this was a huge mistake by the Syrian government, that it didn't realize, that it didn't actually internalize for quite some time. And that allowed its enemies, the Sunni, the quote, the Sunni moderate Arab states who are America's allies, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, most of the Gulf states, Egypt to some extent, to ship in arms, funding, training, and most significantly, people to fight against the Syrian government. When Assad talked about foreigners coming in to fight against the regime, he wasn't inventing that. There were certainly Islamists as well as liberal Democrats in Syria who were calling out loudly for massive change, even for revolution. But with all of the events regionally going on, and with attention focused on Egypt at one time, in Bahrain at another time, in Yemen at another time, a lot of people did not recognize that what was happening in Syria was that the most fanatical, extremist groups were being cultivated by our so-called moderate allies, and these groups are not moderate, and they're not willing to make any kind of agreement with Bashar al-Assad or his government.
Zastrugi is somewhat ironic, to put it mildly, that an ally in this coalition, loosely defined, that the U.S. is ending up supporting is Al-Qaeda. That is,
absolutely.
While the U.S. is attacking, quote-unquote, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Africa, and, you know, elsewhere, that...
Here it is, ready to fund. It talks about using non-lethal support. Well, that's bull. I mean, we're sending in weapons. We're giving weapons, and we say that we claim that we have set up oversight committees to ensure that the weaponry that we send to Syria does not get into the hands of the strongest opposition group, the Nusra Front, which is a direct ally of the Saudis. But there's no way we can see that. There's no way you can trace where the weapons are going. And the facts are, the strongest group in the opposition is the fanatical and most extremist group of all, the Nusra Front and its allies. So, yeah, go ahead.
No, you're listening to Jennifer Lowenstein, Middle East observer, historian, instructor on occasion here at the lecturer here at the UW on the Middle East. Now, Jennifer, there's all this, you know. Well, my regular listeners know that I'm, quite often going on about the cynicism and the hypocrisy and the big lie of humanitarian interventionism.
Yes.
Now, if this whole thing, you know, if this buildup, this push by some in the national security state here, and so on, and it's all not monolithic. Of course, there are clearly military people that they're saying, "Oh, well, let's take our time here."
Yeah.
But what is your assessment of the overall U.S. goal in this?
Well, see, that's a very good question, because your former guest was, I think, very, very kind to Barack Obama. I don't think Obama is any less hesitant than George Bush to show his warmongering side. I, in fact, find him in many ways a worse president than Bush, but that's another story. Obama is not hesitating with Syria because he's a peacenik and he believes in human rights and is worried about the humanitarian situation of a million refugees in Syria. He's hesitating because he understands that right now as things are right now in Syria, you have two choices because of the limitations the greater powers, Russia and the United States, have put on the situation. You have two choices. You have a choice between funding the opposition, which means bringing in a Sunni Islamist government, which could very well turn against the United States, or shoring up Bashar al-Assad's Ba'athist government and bringing back a dictator and the police state that he brutally headed and has since his father's death in 2000. Nobody has said anything about negotiations, or those who have been laughed aside because the opposition, or the majority of the opposition, is refusing outright to sit down at a table in which Assad or his government is present. Therefore, that has become a non-option. The real option that we could have and should have is an option where representatives of the various opposition groups and the Assad government sit down and hammer out some kind of peace. That's not impossible, but it has been made impossible by the various parties playing, including, and I should add, parties such as France in particular, whose foreign minister, Laurent, what's his name, Fabius, has come out and basically said, we're going to strike Syria no matter what. It's got chemical weapons. It's, you know, chemical weapons in Syria have been used now for the past few months. But so far,
actually a much longer history.
But I mean, in this conflict, right. And we know that the perpetrators of those attacks were the rebels. This is the first time it looks as though the attack was perpetrated by the government. I have my doubts.
I found it interesting, if you read the reports closely, that the source of intelligence for the use of gas by the sarin gas or whatever by the Assad regime has come from Israeli intelligence. Does that give you a sense? Are you skeptical about that?
Well, it reinforces my belief that Israel would like to see the region enveloped in conflict, because that's, in a way, the status quo, and it allows Israel to continue with its own projects without being pestered by other parties. It can build 1,600 more settlements every 2 months, and much less attention is paid to it by our media. So, of course, I have great suspicions about that. I also think that Syria does have the artillery shells with which to deliver chemical weapons, and it's had them since 1973. It's had them since the Yom Kippur War, as it's called. But again, the a spokesman for the Syrian Foreign Ministry has made it clear for the past 2.5 years that it would not use, that Syria, the current government of Syria, would not use chemical weapons except as self-defense against foreign aggressors. Now, somebody could say, well, they see parts of the opposition as foreign aggressors, and they can make a very good case for that. That doesn't justify it for me. It's off the table as a source of anything, as a source of warfare.
We do have a caller with a question or comment for our guest today, Jennifer Lowenstein. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello. Yesterday, when I was watching Obama on PBS, he said that he's worried about these chemical weapons falling into the wrong hands. And, you know, when he was talking, if you watch his body language, he was kind of shuffling around and he wouldn't look at the interviewer. You knew he was lying. Because if an attack on the rebels in Syria, I think, would more likely result in the use of weapons by al-Qaeda. You know, the U.S. has a very large blood debt that they have to pay off to al-Qaeda, and they will. If these weapons fall into the hands of al-Qaeda, they will use them on the U.S.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, but one that I think has not been brought up yet and that bothers me considerably is that while we're talking about chemical weapons and how they shouldn't be falling into the wrong hands and we have to strike Syria and we've got to do X, Y, and Z, nobody has bothered to mention the fact that not only has the United States repeatedly used chemical warfare since well before the Vietnam War, Israel, in its last major war against Gaza in 2008-2009, used white phosphorus, it used depleted uranium. In other words, Israel has used chemical warfare against a completely defenseless population in its own backyard, and nobody raised an eyebrow to say that chemical weapons have fallen into the wrong hands. The Americans used chemical warfare in Iraq. They called it Mark 77. That's the updated name for napalm. And it was used in heavily populated areas. It wasn't used in places where they were just trying to tear down buildings. You know, as I said, the history of chemical, biological, and atomic warfare has to be looked at in a much different way in our news, because the biggest villain is the United States, starting in 1945, if not earlier. And second in line are the Israelis, our number one ally. So let's put this in a framework that makes a little bit more sense. Syria's chemical weapons program, while certainly nothing to poo-poo, is a very minor, not a very sophisticated system.
You know, there was a column, an opinion column, in the New York Times the other day where some professor of history at Northwestern University wrote a column about, calling for an attack on Syria regardless of legality.
Oh,
right.
Right. legality anyway, has not been an issue in warfare for the United States warfare began here.
Yeah, but the point here, of course, is that one of the discourses that in an attempt to legitimize U.S. policy, you know, interventions.
Is to try to make it legal.
But it's also rogue states.
Oh, absolutely.
So this guy's saying, the heck with international conventions, laws,
we're going to make this legal the way we made the bombing of Kosovo legal, which is we're going to bypass the Security Council because it's going to vote against us, and we're going to bypass the Geneva Conventions and certain other conventions because the law there is against us, and we're going to go ask the head of NATO, our military alliance, if he thinks it's okay to bomb Kosovo or Serbia. Now, this is the same kind of thing we're facing right now. Let's bend the law so that it's no longer law and turn it to our advantage, get what we want out of the situation, and turn the Middle East even more upside down and inside out than it was beforehand. I wanted to state earlier, when you initially asked me why is it so complex, it's complex because there is not one war going on in Syria. There is a war between the people of Syria and its government. There is a war between externally funded opposition groups and the Assad government. There is a war between the United States and Russia for hegemony in the region. There is a war against Iran being played out by proxy in Syria. There is an Israeli-Palestinian element in this war. Why hasn't Israel amassed its forces on the Golan? I think that would change things considerably overnight. But we aren't thinking of this because Israel doesn't want to do that. It wants attention focused out away from itself.
You know, as is so often the case, we got about 8 minutes left in this hour, but we have three people right now who want to get in with a question or call or comment. Keep it brief, callers, please. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Okay. Thanks for having such a great guest, number one. And it seems that your guest recognizes that President Obama is almost like a Bush clone with regard to foreign policy, aggressive
He's
foreign
worse.
Policy. seems that our foreign policy now is geared toward ramping up Sunni-Shia conflict around the Middle East. And we've lost Afghanistan, I believe, legitimately, and Pakistan. And it seems our foreign policy, as long as the Shia and the Sunnis are fighting one another, it allows the military-industrial complex to bring the cash register.
Yes. Well, I know I have limited time, so I just want to say a couple things very quickly. The sectarian war is also one of the many wars that is being fought and is by no means the primary war of the region. I think people have to know that. If you are interested in finding out just how much more illegal the Obama administration has been in light of these events and others, read Al McCoy's book, Torture and Impunity. It's just out, and it is one of the most informative and shocking books I have ever picked up to read.
Again, that's Professor Al McCoy from here at UW-Madison. Let's go back to the phones. Again, callers, keep it brief. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah. Going to these warmongers and profiteers of war that are talking about the weapons being in the wrong hands. They're in the wrong hands. They're in the United States.
That's exactly right.
The only one that ever used nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And they give most of these chemical and biological weapons to other countries in the form of aid. So it's a joke to talk about that. And to end this note,
yes,
we should rename this Defense Department to the Offense Department. They changed it from the War Department to Defense Department because it sounds better, but it should be named the Offense Department.
You're absolutely right about that. And as for weapons falling into the wrong hands, I mean, the United States has seen to it that they've fallen into the wrong hands. You're right. First of all, we have the wrong hand. We have no business with these weapons. We've used them, and we have supplied some of the worst dictators around the world with stockpiles of these weapons. And when we couldn't supply them because our Congress wouldn't let us, we outsourced our desire for them to be sold through countries such as Israel.
Well, it's actually, there's a stipulation now that violators of human rights, that the Pentagon cannot sell weapons, but the president of the State Department can issue a finding saying that for national security reasons, the blocks by Congress are overridden. Got 5 minutes. Got two callers. Let's get them in. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Alan, this is very informative. I have a question, though. Did this start with the first Bush, and the second Bush just had a hard-on and finished it off, that we got ourselves in this position? And what happens to presidents who lie to us?
You know, you're asking a question that is so that I have such a cynical answer for that I'm almost afraid to put it on the air. This didn't start with the first Bush. This started with the first American president. And if we want to really be honest, it started long before the 13 colonies were aiming towards becoming a republic. You know, it started in 1493. I can go on, but
yeah,
I won't.
You know, I love the mistake analysis that Vietnam was a mistake, that it was aberrational, straying from the path when it was the logical conclusion of all that longer history you referenced. Let's get that caller in. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. I would like to thank you greatly for this program and just make a comment that I find it ironic that the government is willing to go to Syria because of chemical weapons when we still have not tested and treated Vietnam veterans and children for Agent Orange poisoning. We're dying here.
The hypocrisy is stunning. It's unbelievable. I wanted to mention, sort of in this context, very quickly, that one of the things the United States and its allies are constantly doing is pointing at countries like Syria and saying it has not signed the Chemical Weapons Convention. It has not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. It has not ratified the Biological Weapons Convention, et cetera, et cetera. All of these countries, Syria, Iran, which has signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, all of these countries have stated very openly that they are willing to sign and ratify these conventions as soon as Israel does as well. But you see, there is no pressure on Israel to do that. I wanted to go and mention to somebody after I talked about Al McCoy's book, Torture and Impunity, which is absolutely excellent and should be read, that anybody interested in the history of American illegality and the history of rogue states should has. All they have to do is go to the United Nations Charter and to look at the statements made by the United States prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials to see how the United States poisoned the chalice, as it were, of the law by refusing to prosecute Germany for certain war crimes because it knew it committed the same crimes. Read the Nuremberg laws. Read the treaties. They're short. Read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948. It's short, easy to understand, and very specific. Read it and come back and then read the what's in the news.
Jennifer Lowenstein, it's always informative to have you on.